Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders emerging. The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
Even though I'm talking to you about talking to the victim and getting the best evidence, I'm not their best friend and I can't get emotionally involved.
We have a very special Australian true crime for you this week because it's the very first in a new series called the Narelle Fraser Conversations. Of course, as a detective, Narelle was very skillful. A lot of varies, I know, but she was very skillful when it came to getting information out of people in the interview room. So we suggested she try her hand at interviewing some members of the law enforcement community for the podcast. She came up with a fantastic list of people, some of whom are old friends and colleagues of hers, and some, like today's guest, are people she doesn't know personally, but whose work she's long admired. Of course, it doesn't take long for people to feel they've known Narelle their entire lives, and to tell her their innermost thoughts. It's how many of them ended up in jail. But she's using her talent for entertainment value now, so without further ado, I'll hand you over to Narelle to introduce her wonderful guest.
How did a wild, rebellious young teenage girl, expelled from school at 15, married at 18, a mother of three by the time she was 23, struggling to make ends meet, become one of Victoria's first female Crown prosecutors, the first head of the Specialist Sex Offence Unit at the Office of Public Prosecutions, to finally be given the honour of being appointed a QC, a Queen's Counsel. For anyone who needs some inspiration or motivation to keep applying for jobs when you just keep getting those knockbacks, when the career that you've set your heart on and your mind on isn't going to plan, I'll give you a tip. Go and grab a coffee and have a listen to my first ever guest on the Narelle Fraser Conversations. Allow me to introduce you to Michelle Williams. Welcome, Michelle.
Thanks very much, Narelle. Wow, that's a great introduction. I like to think I'm still that young, rebellious girl. It's a bit older. Well, and achieved a few things along the way, but
Just a few, Michelle.
Yeah,
just a few. I thought we might start with your early years. Could you just give us a little bit of background about those early years?
I suppose I really had a very uneventful, normal childhood. You know, I didn't come from a legal family, which is sometimes the normal path for where I ended up. No, I had played in the street as a kid, which is what we did in those days. All the local kids played together. I went to the local state school. I went to the local high school. I suppose I really did love school in the early years. Believe it or not, I was actually a good athlete. I was a good runner. And I had, probably flowing from that, a pretty competitive spirit.
Mm-hmm.
My mother used to say, "You've got the most determined mouth I've ever seen." So I guess the early days showed some determination and, maybe that's one of the qualities I've brought to be able to do what I did. Ultimately, I was expelled from school and I went to work for a couple of years. I met my then husband when I was 16, got married at 18. And it wasn't really Yeah, very young, But you know what? I wouldn't have it any other way. I think it turned out to be fantastic in the end because my children are my best friends.
Really?
So
how many kids have you got?
I've got three and six grandchildren. So,
that's lovely.
You know, the fact is that it wasn't until I had them that I started to think, what am I going to do? I do want to educate them, and they were the motivating factor. So I wanted to put them through school because we didn't have any money. We, you know, things were
What did your husband
tough.
Do at 18? Gee, that's a lot of responsibility for an 18-year-old to be married. And then you've got, what is it, three kids by the time, like within 5 years.
Yeah. He was 3 years older than me. He was 21 when we were married. And he hadn't finished his studies, but he went on to do night school. I mean, I can remember the years, you know, making him butter and Vegemite on saladas for dinner because we really couldn't afford much. He'd go off to night school. He got qualified as an accountant. He went into the finance area. And, you know, things did pick up over the years financially. But at the time that I decided to go back to school, so I went to night school for 2 years.
With three kids?
Had two at that stage and then became pregnant with the third one in the second year of night school.
So were you breastfeeding?
I was
uni?
Breastfeeding, yes. I was breastfeeding the third one when I started uni, and one at school, one at kinder, breastfeeding the third one. And
three kids and breastfeeding, that's not enough for you, not enough of a challenge. You just felt you needed something else. Yeah.
Well,
I can see that.
I guess so. I guess my mother was right about that determined mouth. So, I needed the challenge. And the challenge, though, changed along the way. The challenge was, and the purpose changed. So, although in a way they dovetailed, I'll explain what I mean by that. So I wanted to be a teacher. That's what I wanted to do because I felt that that would really dovetail into being a mother and having the hours that, although teachers today might disagree with that, but it was deemed to be an occupation that would sit in or fit in.
It would
in.
Suit your lifestyle.
Yeah, with a family lifestyle. So that was that was the idea. When I'd finished night school, I applied for all these teachers' positions, you know, at various colleges. And in those days, you had to fill in eight spots. You had to fill in the whole in your application. You had to fill them all in from the top to the last. And I had them all filled in, but I didn't have actually the top one. I didn't know what to put in. I'd run out of options.
Ideas,
So I put in arts law. So it was that stroke of a pen that really...
That changed your life.
That changed my life, yeah. So for those people, you know, maybe students, kids, families, you know, you don't necessarily freak out if your child hasn't got the best marks. You know, there are always other ways to come at it. And I personally think these days too much emphasis is put on that. A lot of emphasis is put on children who don't know what they want to do. They haven't got a clue. So there is another path, or can be another path. Mind you.
But sometimes you've got to go looking for that path, don't you? Like sometimes those paths don't just appear. You've got to make a bit of an effort, don't you?
Look, I couldn't agree more with that. It does. Things don't just land on your lap necessarily. You do have to go looking, and you have to.
You've got to show a bit of
initiative.
Initiative, don't you?
Yeah, and make choices, you know, make decisions.
Yeah.
You know, as I say, I was on the path to becoming a teacher that never eventuated, and I took a completely different path. I thought I'd give myself 2 years at Monash. I used to trundle out there with my Volkswagen. I'd drop off the youngest one at my mother-in-law, breastfeeding her before I left the others, school, kinder, so on.
So really, also what you're saying there, Michelle, is that it wasn't an easy path.
No.
You had to organise things. You had all this other stuff going on, but you obviously became passionate about... Well, you started to really like law, and you had to work hard at it. Not so much the law itself, but everything around you. Would that be right?
Oh, absolutely. And it became a challenge for me. I thought I'd give it 2 years. I discussed it with my mother and my mother-in-law in particular. By that stage, my then husband wasn't too keen on any of this at
all. Do you have to pout your lips when you talk about your... My then husband.
Oh, I know. I shouldn't do that. Oh, look, we now get on and I don't really see him. I never repartnered. He's remarried twice, so that tells you a story in itself anyway.
I don't know if we've got time for that.
No. That's a whole different path. Look, he wasn't particularly supportive. He saw all this as, if you like, loss of control of me as things, as the years went on.
Yes.
And so what I learnt to do is I learnt to segregate my life. I even had what I used to call my uni clothes and my mother wife clothes, and then, as it turned out, wife of the businessman type clothes, executive clothes. So, you know, became a bit of a split personality maybe, I don't know.
And, you know, that might be why you were able to manage such a stressful career, because you learned to compartmentalise things, whereas I couldn't, and I think that's where I fell down. But this isn't about me today, unfortunately. This is about you. So I've got to keep on track with you, Michelle. So,
but Narelle, I think you're exactly right in that. I did learn to, if you like, segregate segments of my life.
Mm.
And what I like to think is I devoted a lot of time to both. It is very difficult these days. I wanted to be a stay-at-home mum. I wanted to do that. That's what I chose to do.
Mm.
So at the same time, I chose to study, go back, educate myself. So the study part of it necessarily happened late at night, and I learnt for that not to interfere in the as much as possible. And as the children got older, you know, they're at school, longer hours, that sort of stuff. I would study during the day if I wasn't at uni. So,
take my hat off to you. So let's get on to your career in law, which is pretty unbelievable. Can you remember one of your first trials, a matter that you prosecuted? Can you remember being terribly nervous, like I imagine you would be? Because you are up in front of everybody, and it almost like... It's all up to you.
Yeah, I think in many ways I never lost that nervousness, but I think what happens is you learn to harness it, you learn to work with it.
So how did you harness it?
Well, I think you just, you know, you do become attuned to it. Look, I remember when I first started, my hands used to shake. So I got to the stage, and this is when I was, you know, very, very junior, before I became a Crown prosecutor, and you'd be wanting to tender a document and your hand would be shaky. And so I tried not doing that. I tried to think of another way. How am I going to do this? You learn to conquer your nerves and you...
And how did you learn that?
I think by practice. You know, sometimes that was a difficult part of doing, well, I think every barrister faces this, just learning to get over the nerves, learning to... And that's by experience, by practice, by... And for me, it was about absolutely about preparation.
I was just going to say, knowing your brief and knowing everything that you can,
right,
so that whatever they throw at you,
that's right,
you're not underneath your dog paddling and trying to keep above water, know it so well, your case, that you can just throw anything at me and I'll be able to handle it.
That's right. And so I used to be confident that I knew my case better than anyone in the courtroom, including the judge, defence counsel, maybe except for the police who had charged the person. But for me, it was about making the case come to life, particularly for a jury. So, you know, the bulk of my career were jury trials and the bulk of that prosecuting murder trials. So, you know, there was a real incentive for victims, the family, to ensure that I was doing the best job I possibly could do. And I loved the work, so I was pretty lucky.
You're in your element.
I was in my element, yeah.
Can you tell us about you mostly did murder trials?
Yeah.
Is there one that sticks out in your mind?
I suppose there are a number that stick in my mind, and for different reasons. I mean, Peter Dupas, I prosecuted him twice. I prosecuted him first in 2004, and then I prosecuted him for a murder of a woman called Margaret Maher, and then I prosecuted him some years later for the murder of Messina Halvagas. And that was a retrial, and that matter does stick in my mind in particular because it had been an investigation that had gone on for quite some time, and then there'd been a retrial. And so for the Halvagas family, it was extremely rewarding to get a guilty verdict after so long.
Would you mind just going into a little bit about who Margaret Maher was, what happened, and a little bit about Messina as well? Because George Messina's father has become a great advocate for victims, hasn't he?
He has.
But a lot of people won't get the connection. So would you mind going through that for us?
The time I was prosecuting Margaret Maher, there had already been a trial of the murder of a woman by the name of Nicole Patterson. And so Peter Dupas was charged with that murder. And it was a particularly, I did not prosecute that one, but it was a particularly brutal murder. And by the time I prosecuted Margaret Maher, which actually she was murdered before Nicole Patterson, if you can follow the sequence. Margaret Maher was a prostitute. She was found dead on the roadside on a highway. Nicole Patterson, in terms of her murder, she had had two breasts removed. She'd been stabbed many, many times.
It was in her home, wasn't it?
It was in her home. She was a psychologist, and Peter Dupas had got her phone number, and he ended up going to her address and pretended to want to see her. So he had had no connection with her. So she was a person who he sought out to kill, and killed in a really brutal manner. It was a signature, what we call a signature, and it happens very rarely in the legal world that you can rely on that signature. So when I prosecuted Margaret Maher, she had one breast removed. So the unusual method of killing, bearing in mind the case was, who did this to Margaret Maher? Who was the killer? What we call identification. Who was it? We know how she's killed. Her body was located, and there was some relatively small amount of DNA found at the scene. Peter Dupas' DNA was located just a short distance from the scene. But the really telling evidence was the removal of the breast. So when we got to trial for the Margaret Maher matter, I led the evidence of the Nicole Patterson matter.
Because it was so similar.
It was so similar, so strikingly similar. And we also led evidence of, in the world, let alone Australia, how unusual this was. So pretty rare to get.
I was going
to
say, did they allow it?
Very, very rare. It'd be one of, well, it's the only case or one of the very few cases as far as I know, in existence, where the proof of one murder new lead evidence of another murder. Mm. And the whole reason for that is to prove that it's the same person that did it. That's the connection between it.
And did they allow that in evidence?
It was allowed, yes, it was allowed in evidence and was held on appeal that it was admissible. So we held that conviction. So I first met George the Hell Vargas when I was prosecuting Peter Dupas in 2004 for the murder of Margaret Marr. George was sitting in the courtroom. This is in the magistrate's court at this stage. So for the listeners who may not know, at first instance you have at the moment what they call a committal process to see if there's sufficient evidence for the matter to go to trial. And we were at that stage of the legal process. So number of witnesses being called. And George was just there. Someone pointed him out to me and I nodded at some stage during a break and he nodded back. And I think it was on day two that I approached him and, you know, was very short. I understand you're George Hell Vargas. I'm Michelle Williams, pleased to meet you. And there on in, I think we had a very mutual respect for each other.
Yes.
So he would often be at many trials that I did. He would often be at court. And I'd often see him, you know, crossing Lonsdale Street and we'd, you know, he'd say, "Hello, darling, how are you?" I'd say, I'm good, George, how are you?" And the thing about George's, if you go back to what happened, George was also had also followed the Nicole Patterson trial. And at that point in George's life and his family's life, Peter Dupas had not been charged, but ultimately was, for the murder of George's daughter, Messina Hell Vargas. So George, you know, I don't think it's too high to say he was haunted at that time. He was extremely sad. He was
traumatized.
So for him to have a connection and to try and follow other cases that were going on became a very important part of his life. And
maybe not a healing. I mean, you'd never get over it, but maybe just to help him manage. It was just a way that he used.
And in the background, he was also asking the police and the director of public prosecutions at the time, what's happening? Is Peter Dupas going to be charged with the murder of his daughter?
Did he know that Dupas had done?
Yes. It was well known, with us, with the prosecutors, that Peter Dupas was suspected, but there wasn't sufficient evidence to charge him. So that added to the trauma that George lived through. And also why I really respected George, because in the whole time I knew him, he never interfered in any of the cases. He never conducted himself, you know, really, really well. Knowing that Peter Dupas had killed Messina, Peter Dupas was charged, and I didn't do the first trial, but there was a retrial. It went all the way to the High Court, but I did the second trial. And again,
why was a retrial ordered?
There was a retrial ordered because it was said, there were a couple of different reasons. It was said that the judge hadn't given the sufficient identification warning. So, yeah. When it came back on, I was privy to the first trial, the transcript and everything, but I believe we actually got it up better in the second trial for some reason.
It just seemed to work better.
It worked better. Yep.
Flow, I suppose.
For me, when I'm prosecuting, I've got to be able to see it in my head.
Yes.
I've got to be able to visualise it.
Yes.
So I do a lot of work with interviewing, conferencing witnesses, always with my police and my instructing solicitor, because I want them to be prepared. And I want to make it clear, there's a big difference between conferencing your witnesses and coaching your witnesses.
Of course,
you don't do that, but you have statements of what they're going to say. So in order for them to understand who I am and for me to understand who they are and to get the best evidence, in every case I did, I spent a lot of time conferencing witnesses, going to the crime scene. The detectives took me out to the cemetery. They'd point out to me in the case of Messina Hal Vargas, you know, where, because she had been murdered at her grandmother's cemetery and stabbed to death in a most brutal way. So for me, it was really important. I need to see this. And because we had a number of witnesses from the cemetery, I needed to be able to visualise where they were at a particular point, what they could see, and so on.
Would most people do that? Would most people in your position, to me, with my experience with trials, which is nothing compared to you, but I can't remember anybody doing that with a case of mine.
Yeah, I think some did, perhaps not as much as what I did. Some don't at all. Those who don't think, well, it's just purely an objective exercise for them, and they, I guess, don't get, well, I got much more involved in my cases. That's the way I would put it.
Was that a criticism by your colleagues? Like, oh, you're getting too involved?
No, I don't think that was ever said, because, and when we say too involved, there is a balance to all this. So you can't get subjectively involved, because then you lose what you're trying to do. So it's really about, for me, it was about what had happened. Sure, I can read that in the brief of evidence. I know that. I understand that. But I need to visualise it. So that was something that was important to me, because when I open to the jury, I'm telling them what happened. For me to tell them what happened, I have to see it. I have
to
understand it. And I have to make it come to life. I have to let them see it and hear it as well. So it was very important for me.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Thank you to the following patrons who help us keep going in these strange and challenging times. Alicia Vicker, Will Harth, Crystal Wilson, Ali Johns, Lisa Knight, and Kate Smith. Coming up on the Narelle Fraser Conversations, she and Michelle discuss the very controversial topic of women's safety. But first, their shared passion.
You spend a lot of time with the victim. I think that is just so admirable, because then it's hard enough for a victim to go into a court, let alone a court where there is a jury and all these people with the wigs and, you know, it's all very officious looking. And I know we do a lot now to help the victim feel a lot more at ease. But I would think that by you spending time with the victim, not only does the victim get to know you better and feel more comfortable with you, but would I be correct in saying that you would get to know the victim and you would think, he or she, they're going to go really well with this particular bit, and they're not going to, you know, they might struggle a bit here. You get to know each other's nuances, I suppose.
Yeah. Look, I think there's a couple of aspects to that. Bearing in mind with the murder trials, obviously the victims are deceased, but I'm dealing with their family.
Thinking of sex offences, you're right. Sorry, yes.
Yeah, that's okay.
So you don't speak to the dead.
Mind you, it wasn't murder trials, you know, of course, wasn't the only work I did. And sex offences, of course, you would.
Yeah.
And they, in that case, they are a witness as well. So they form, you know, go into that category, if you like, where they're both a traumatised victim, but they're a witness. And so they have to give evidence about the most graphic things that have happened to them. And in recent years, we've made a lot of inroads into the process. I think there's more that can be done in making the process better for victims and more efficient. For some victims to be cross-examined, you know, not once but twice, I think is archaic, and that is still occurring. And when I say twice, at the committal, in the committal process, if they're an adult victim, and at the trial. But look, in those cases, absolutely. I had to and did and spend a lot of time conferencing the victims. I never did it on my own because I never wanted it levelled at me that I had somehow or other worded the victim up, who was a witness.
Yes.
So you always had my solicitor with me and what I called my team. My solicitor, my informant, who's the detective who's investigated the case, and if I had a junior, my junior. So we would work as a team. And, yes, we would, in the case of, for example, as we're talking about sex offences, it was really important for that victim to have trust in me.
Oh, yes, very much so. And I've got to say that I do apologise because most of my offences that I have gone to trial with were alive and, they were victims of, horrific sexual assaults, whereas you were talking about a murder and, of course, you don't get to speak to them. So I do apologise for that.
I'll come back to that in a minute because it is important to clarify that as well. But yeah, really important for the victims of sexual assault.
Oh, very much.
For them to trust me. But, you know, that's a double-edged sword. So I used to always say to them, look, I'll do my best. I don't make any promises. But, you know, we're going to talk about this now. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk so that I can get the best evidence from you. Mm-hmm. I've got a copy of your statement in front of me. I want to take you through some of those things so that I know that you can actually verbalise this, because there are many victims who couldn't.
You're
They're
right.
so traumatised they actually couldn't speak.
And it was hard enough for them to do the statement
exactly.
in front of one person,
exactly.
let alone a jury.
Yeah. Mm. So
and all these strangers.
Yeah. And sometimes I used to say to them, look, I'm telling you, I'm being selfish about this. I want to win this case.
Mm.
So I need to get the best evidence from you. So come on, let's just. So, you know, it was that type of conference, I guess. From my point of view, it helped me to get the best evidence from them and therefore to make the best case that I could.
You know, that's very similar. When I took a lot of statements from sexual assault victims, from rape victims.
Yeah.
And I used to do the same thing. I used to put myself in the position. Not everyone can because it gets very, you can get terribly involved in it and not see the wood for the tree sort of. But I used to put myself in the position of the victim. And if she said she was down a laneway and it was really dark, I would actually put myself there and I'd say things like, I'd think to myself, is it dark? What can I see?
Yeah.
How am I feeling?
That's right.
And I think I took a better statement that way because I could put myself in that position. So you're saying exactly the same thing in your position. You would go to the scene and just on while we're talking about Dupas or whoever for that matter, you must have prosecuted in situations where you didn't like, you loathed, you despised an accused person, I imagine. So how did you deal with those feelings? Because it's very hard, isn't it, to not show in some way how much you despise somebody like Peter Dupas.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question because a bit like parallel in a way, you may not think of it this way, is with the victim as well. Mm-hmm. Because I, even though I'm talking to you about talking to the victim and mm-hmm. getting the best evidence, I'm not their best friend, and I can't get emotionally involved because then I can't do my job.
Yes.
And so the same I would put it, albeit for different reasons, I never really thought, do I hate the accused or not hate the accused? I mean, I hate what he's done.
Mm.
And when I say he, it was mainly men.
Mm.
I hate what they've done. So it's never really been an emotion that's troubled me.
Gee, that is amazing, because I think, looking back, I think that was one of maybe my issues, is that I tried not to become emotionally involved.
Yeah.
But I used to, particularly in response to, say, a sexual assault victim, sometimes I just wanted to put my arms around them and say, I am so sorry, and then you do become emotionally attached. And with offenders, I actually wanted to get into their head to understand why they did this certain thing. And that is becoming, I'm not being able to compartmentalise it, whereas what you're saying is you could, and maybe that's the secret as to why I got PTSD and you're as good as gold.
Well, maybe I do. I have it as well. I just don't know it. there's a lot of what you say is accurate, and I can understand that, but I don't want to create the wrong impression. I can mm-hmm. tell you, with Peter Dupas, I did a lot of homework on him before I prosecuted him. I got every bit of history.
Mm-hmm.
I got old files, old matters. Mm-hmm. I went into, as you say, to try and get into his head. But I think the difference is I wasn't really trying to get into his head. I was really just trying to look at what he had done. I mean, there are many people who have very bad upbringings, mm-hmm. have bad experiences, and that's something I'm really aware of
mm-hmm.
in the work I do now, and I can maybe
talk
about
that. Which we will touch on in a minute, yep.
Yeah. It sidetracks you a little bit. For me, it would sidetrack me. I need to concentrate on what is the evidence I've got to prove this case. And so if you want to say hate or emotions or don't like or, this is a despicable act,
mm-hmm.
yes, of course, I mm-hmm. harness some of those things. Mm-hmm. That just harnesses, well, it did for me anyway, to make me want to do a better job. And the trick was for me to remain focused on what I was doing and what I can prove.
Maybe my issue was that I tried to understand why somebody would do this, whereas clearly from what you're saying, you didn't actually try and understand it. What you were doing was just getting all the information, and you were very fact-focused.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think evidence, I'd say evidence-focused. So when we use the word evidence, what is it that, what are the pieces of evidence, which may be, witnesses who get into the witness box, who give evidence. It may be DNA evidence, expert evidence, crime scene photos. See, crime scene photos, that's another thing. I used to pore over the crime scene photos and or videos. So we would have the police who are investigating would take a number of photographs. The pathologists who would do the autopsy would take a number of photographs. So, quite confronting, many of those photographs. But for me, they always told me something.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to look at and examine each and every one of those in fine detail. And, in fact, I had one case where a very neat piece of evidence came up, and that was mid-trial. I don't claim that I picked this up, actually, my instructor.
Well, let's claim it for
let's
today.
Let's claim it. I'll pretend it was me. But we picked up, looking at one of the photographs with a magnifying glass, we picked up, it had to do with an accused was talking about having watched a TV show with his aunt in her home and then apparently leaving, whereas our case was that he smashed her over the head a number of times with a hammer
mm-hmm.
and killed her. But when we looked with a magnifying glass, there was a newspaper there and we could see what date it was open to.
Wow.
And so it was, Yeah, it was a wow moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a real wow moment.
Sort of gotcha moment.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
And he was, well, not necessarily for that reason, but it was a nice piece of evidence that we were able to get before the jury.
That's very nice of you to say a nice piece of evidence. That is that's huge. Really, isn't it, in the scheme of things?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
So you're talking about these photos, you know, that some of them were just so bad.
Yeah.
Did you ever look at any photos and it was like, oh, my God, I just did looking at photos of young women that had been murdered and particularly, you know, breasts cut off and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
How did you manage that?
Well, yeah. I don't know. Maybe I didn't manage it. No, to be serious. I used to set aside a time to look at the photos. Mm-hmm. So I used to close my door in chambers and I would sit down by myself and look at the photos for quite a long time and sometimes then many times over. Mm-hmm. Of course, there were some that were very, very confronting. Mm-hmm. I mean, one case in particular that in that way does... Well, it stays with me in the sense of I remember it. And this girl was a beautiful girl, early 20s, I think, from memory. She was a hairdresser. Mm. And she, like many other women, went out on a Saturday night. The problem was she never came home. So she went out with some other girlfriends and they had a few drinks. She... apparently took half an ecstasy tablet. She wasn't a drug user. She was a gorgeous girl, but apparently some of them did do that or maybe still do that.
She tried something a bit different.
Yeah. And, you know, to be honest, that I was aware that some girls did that because they didn't want to drink. They didn't want to put on weight. And so they would do that and they didn't want to pay the cost.
Mm.
So sad as it is, it was actually cheaper for her to have half an ecky.
Mm.
And anyway, long, long story short, there was this fellow who was a drug user and had priors, you know, a mile long.
Mm.
And somehow or other, somebody put her in touch with him. The idea was that they were in Port Melbourne. Well, he wasn't, but she was there with other friends. She thought she was going to meet up with other friends. That didn't eventuate. She ended up going with him to a hotel in South Melbourne. And we had CCTV footage of them going into the hotel, hotel motel, and they both looked fine. He had driven. He looked fine.
Mm.
She looked fine.
Mm.
They were walking in. They were laughing. She was looking at her phone.
Mm.
She had been, about 10 minutes later, slashed to death in the most unimaginable ways ever. He smashed the mirror in the room. He slashed her with the shards of glass from the mirror. We think that she may have had her spinal cord severed but was still alive before he finished her off. Those photographs were horrific and looking at the scene. But prior to that, about to my memory, maybe it was longer, maybe it was half an hour, but it wasn't hours. They had gone in and we had CCTV footage of the guy at the motel, them signing in. They looked fine. So he pleaded guilty in the end and it was taken into account, his drug psychosis in terms of sentencing. But it was just one of those absolutely needless, horrible, horrible outcomes for a girl who simply, and we've seen this many times, young women who go out, you know, Jill Maher was another one. Yep. I prosecuted many, unfortunately. So, yeah, it's a... I don't know what the answer is really currently for women. Once upon a time, I used to think we could all just, we're free. We're entitled to go out. We're entitled to come home alive.
Yep.
We're entitled to walk
Absolutely.
In a park.
Yep.
We're entitled to walk down the street. But, and there is a but for me now with that,
yes.
I think in this day and age, you've got to protect yourself. After Jill Maher, I had a number of junior prosecutors come to me because I think everybody felt really a bit traumatised by that.
Could we just give me a brief rundown on Jill Maher?
I didn't actually prosecute the case. She worked for the ABC. She was walking home, I think it was a Friday night, after drinks in Brunswick. She'd been with some other people. She lived a very, very short distance away and she was simply walking home. Mm. We've seen video footage of that, and she was brutally murdered and raped. So there was a lot of disquiet, I think it's fair to say, and shock that this could happen. And
because so many of us, I suppose, have been in that situation, haven't
yes,
we? Where we've been out for a night.
Absolutely.
And you can't be bothered waiting for a taxi or whatever, and you think, I don't have far to go.
Correct.
That's, I think, the frightening thing about Jill Maher.
That was the frightening thing. And because I was a senior woman in chambers, so some of the more junior prosecutors would come to me with issues or... And I remember a couple did over this, and one in particular said to me, Michelle, this could have been me.
Yes.
I live in a city. This could have been me. I've done this. And I said, yes, and so have I.
Mm.
We've all done it. Mm. We've all gone home, and we should be entitled to.
Mm.
But, and I keep using the but, because we now live in a world where we know that's not the case, that we've really got to try and protect ourselves. And, you know, I said to this particular prosecutor, well, you know, what are you going to do now? You're not going to walk home. You're going to give that taxi driver an extra $20 to take you that short distance.
Mm.
I lived in South Melbourne for a while, for quite a few years, and in my early days at the bar as a barrister. And, you know, we used to always go out on a Friday night, have drinks. I wasn't far from home.
Mm.
So I think we all related to what happened to Jill Maher, and that's why we're all in shock.
Mm.
Since then, it's... Unfortunately, there have been a number of other cases.
So just on that emotional side, so you had junior people coming to you to say, you know, God, that could have been me with Jill Maher, for instance. So what sort of emotional support do lawyers, solicitors, barristers, do you have a...
Yeah, it's called Friday Night Drinks. Where we unwind, we exchange stories, we support each other. And, you know, we look over the years, for me, that was the best way to unwind. I know all the psychologists and all the, you know, the professionals would say, oh, you shouldn't use alcohol. And well, that's true. And I don't necessarily mean it in that way. But to be surrounded by colleagues who understand you, know what your case, if you've spoken to them about your case and for me, I developed quite good bonds with the detectives that I worked with, because many of my cases would have gone for 4 weeks, 6 weeks.
Mm.
You're seeing them every day. So at the end of a case, we'd often have a drink and socialise. But it's having that connection. For me, I also had my children as a support.
Mm.
I've got my brothers and sisters as well, but I probably chose not to speak to them as much about my work. I would from time to time, but it just became part of my life again, maybe maybe separating my work from family to a large extent.
I do understand that, because that was a real issue with me. For instance, to share the photos that you saw of the young girl in the hotel in South Melbourne, there's not many people, apart from the people that you work with, that you could really discuss that with.
Exactly.
And I found that I had so many issues that I couldn't talk about with anybody, that in the end it just all boiled over, you know, with my PTSD. And I also think we used to have Friday night drinks as well. We used to have drinks back at the, you know, in the squads. But, and I understand why, but Christine Nixon, she stopped all that.
Yes.
And in my view, what it did was it didn't give us anywhere.
Doesn't give you the outlet.
Correct.
Yeah. Because whether, look, as I say, I preface this by saying, no, it's not a good idea to use alcohol as a crutch. But, yes, at the end of a week, when you're with your colleagues and you've got things in common, you've got...
And you can talk openly.
And you can talk openly, because that's the other issue with the work that I did, certainly the work you did as well, Narelle. You can't talk to... There's a You know, no. There's not everybody you can talk no. to. You,
there's very
and,
few.
And sort of in a way you don't want to. I found I like to talk with people who understood. I know many people at the bar who have suffered, particularly defence counsel, I think, more than anything, because they're perhaps operating more solely, whereas I was operating in a team of prosecutors and so on. So, but I do know many people who've had issues and they've had to deal with it.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime, made in association with the Acast Creator Network. Thank you to Narelle Fraser and Michelle Williams. And Michelle will be back for another conversation with Narelle in coming weeks. Thank you also to patrons Megan Ferguson, Nick, Jody Edwards, Jennifer Biles, Laura Nish, and Alice Jenkins. We'll be back next week, and until then, please take care and remember that everyone's going crazy in different ways, so try not to be too hard on each other or on yourself. Take care.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Australian True Crime, the live show, is coming.